Okie dokie. All right, I'll post last Friday's lecture and today's lecture up online by this afternoon in case people want to review anything. Don't forget to meet with your groups, figure out how to do that. And the next thing to begin reading is the Tao Te Ching, which is there in the course content folder for you to download as a reading. That's a translation of Tao Te Ching that my good friend Lu Wen Long and I did when he was staying here for a year, when he came over from China to be a visiting scholar, and he and I would get together every day or at least a few times a week, and we would go through translating one poem at a time. The Platonist group is going to try to get together today right after class, so people stay behind for that if you're in the Platonist group. What else to say? Did y'all think about this weekend in some significant way? Did you think over the weekend about pressures and impressions, oppressions and repressions and depressions and impressions, expressions, digressions? Whoops, that's not the same thing, but whatever. Who here went to a party over the weekend? Y'all don't even party like they used to in 1999. What's up? What's up that? Y'all spend the whole weekend studying? How many people went to a party? Hold your hand up. See, now there's a couple more people admitting to it, okay? And how many of you studied all weekend? Oh. Well, and then how many of you just laid around and didn't do anything all weekend? Okay. Very good. Well, see, that's all right. It's a hard life we work. Okay. Hey, Daniel. All right, so don't forget about your groups. Download the Tao Te Ching and start reading it. You should read the... there's a short meaning of keywords in the text. So you should... It's at the very beginning, but I just want to make sure you read it. Read that. And then there's a short introduction. And then it tells you to... The poems are actually mixed up a little bit from the way that they're traditionally given. So then you'd read poem one. And then poems 38 to 80, 81. They're real short. So, I mean, it's not like, okay, they're super short. So you want to read the keywords, the little short introduction, and then you definitely want to read poem 1 and then poem 38 to 81. I think that's the way it looks like in your syllabus, but, you know, since we're already a little bit off the syllabus schedule, I wanted to make sure I repointed that out. Carl Jaspers refers to the period. Carl Jaspers refers to the period 800 BCE to 200 BCE before the Common Era, in case you don't know. He refers to this period as the Axial Age, and there'll be a chapter later on inside of his Way to Wisdom that y'all will be reading about history, and that'll be a selection actually that's taken out of another book he did. He refers to this as the Axial Age, and I've mentioned this in here before. The Axial Age is that period of time when all across what you'd call the ancient world, from North Africa to China, from from the Greek colonies in southern Italy down to the Persia and Israel, all of the great thinkers and figures all show up. And some of them within 100, within 50 or 60 years of each other. And they're all asking these really important questions. And they're still the questions that we ask. So in one sense, you could actually call this from Homer. You could say like from Homer to Isaiah. There's another thing. This is Jaspers who points this out. There's another thinker who makes use of this same idea and extends it out to about 500 CE, in which case you could talk about from Homer to Muhammad. And Jaspers actually at one point, I think in one of the first couple of chapters, he actually points out, he said, that we have technically and materially progressed past Plato is of no surprise to anyone. But if you stop and you really think about it, we have not spiritually, psychologically, ethically, philosophically progressed past Socrates and Plato and Buddha and Confucius, and this person, Lao Tzu, the old, whose name just means the old man, so Chinese wisdom. So the axial age is basically, you might say, the very idea of an axis, right? That everything is kind of circling around this axis period. The same questions, why do accidents happen? Why do we suffer? Why do we struggle? Why do we die? Why are we guilty? Why is there good? Right? How is there evil that happens to good people? What does it mean to be virtuous? What does it mean to be pious? What is it, is there a God? Is there not a God? Are there many gods? Is there only one God? Is there actually only one living force that guides itself through all living things? Is there a cosmic force that guides the entirety of the cosmos? Is this all of the life there is in the universe? Or is there more? All these questions. And mostly what we've done is materially expand the area of research, right? So we've gone from a little bitty world around which the sun turns to a 21 billion light year wide universe. But we're still asking the same questions. Are we alone? Is this all there is? Why is there something rather than nothing? Is there a God? What are things made of? We're still asking the same kinds of questions. So part of your group assignment and part of your work as you're doing the things that you're doing throughout the course of the semester, reading the things and engaging in discussions and what have you, is to kind of pinpoint how thinkers like the pre-Socratics and the Taoists of China and the... Let's go ahead and just say the Buddhists of India and the prophets of Israel and the Magi of Persia and the priests of Egypt and go on and go on and go on, how these people have asked questions that still keep coming up in every day. So for your groups, you'll be concentrating on the pre-Socratic philosophers, and each person in your group will be given a pre-Socratic philosopher that you'll read the chapter about that philosopher in the Introduction to Greek Natural Philosophy, and you'll learn that person's way of thinking, and then you'll look out in the world today, and you'll see where in popular culture, where in science, where in religion, where in, you know, whatever, do we still see those questions this person asked or those answers this person gave still popping up after 2,500 years, right? So I asked you for today to read chapter 1 of the, I can never remember the name of my own book, Introduction to Ancient Greek Natural Philosophy. It's called the Mythopoeic Worldview. And we basically looked at two ancient Greek poets. It's a very interesting thing about how important language was to the Greeks. This word, myth, when someone says that's a myth, what do they normally, what's your name again?
Aurora.
Aurora? Oh, Aurora. Aurora, rosy-fingered dawn. When a person asks, or a person makes the statement, that's just a myth, what do they usually mean by that? Just a made-up story. It's not real, right? It's a lie, actually, some people say, right? So for a lot of people, when you hear this, they mean, when you say that's just a myth, they mean, oh, that's just a story. Meaning by that, it's a lie or unfactual. And that's kind of the way the word has come to mean over the course of 2,000 years of, you know, being separated away from the Greeks who originally made use of the word. And for now, in one sense, to say here, oh, that's just a story. That's just a story. What we're meaning by that is, you know, you tell the story, you told the fib, you didn't tell the truth. But in reality, this is actually probably right. For the Greeks, mythos meant narrative. Right? It just meant a narrative. And it's in that more technical way, sometimes people who are scholars, even if they are Christians, even if they are Jews, right? If they're scholars, they will talk about the Christian mythology and Hebrew mythology, because that's a technical term, okay? It means the narrative, the how is it so? And the Greeks would themselves over time counterpose mythos to logos. Okay. Now, do you know what's your name?
Robert,
do you know what logos means?
I don't know. Is that the same as the ethos, pathos of logos?
Yeah, it's close to those things. And so when you look at logos and it's like at the end of a word like biology, it usually means like study of life, right? So what, huh? Where'd somebody go? Who said that? So what does logos, mean? It means a study. The word literally means word. So that's the word, right? the beginning of John, the book of John, the gospel according to John. How does it start? Do you notice how the book of John starts? I don't know whether that's a step forward or a step backward. From 20 years ago, people probably have said, well, how does John begin? And they would have got to chapter 3 before I stopped them. How does John begin? Who knows? In the beginning was the Word. N-R-K Logos. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Okay, so that's how the book of John begins. John is heavily influenced by Greek philosophy, actually. So the Greeks have these two ways of talking. One is mythos, which is the narrative, and one is logos, which is the word, the study, right? The rational account. So usually this would be the word that you would look at and you want to say, oh yeah, that's the way things are. So that's logic, because it's the basic of logic. See? But over here, what we have, and what we started off with in chapter 1, is what's called the mythopoeic worldview. And so there's another way that Greeks spoke. So they spoke how you would say rationally, they spoke by way of narrative, and they spoke by way of making. Poesis, which of course is the root word for what word? If you look at it, poem, poetry. So this is a making. When we talk then about the mythopoeic, what we mean by that is a way of making a narrative of saying this is the way things are. Okay. This is how it came about. This is what it's all about. Philosophy's origin is in the mythopoeic. That's part of its beginnings, right? Its source is in doubt. Its source is in wonder. Its source is in the abandonment or the forsakenness that occurs when we realize that we have these conditions that we live in. That's its source. But it begins at these moments when someone decides, let's make an account. And literally, let's make an account of beginnings. Right? So Hesiod, the person who you read about this for today, Hesiod and Homer, they're the people who you could say standardized a narrative about the Greek gods and about the origin of the world for the ancient Greeks. Okay? How does that begin? Oh, let's literally turn to the hymnal. First of all, chaos chasm came to be, and then broad-breasted earth, the ever immovable seat of all the immortals who possess snowy Olympus's peak and murky Tartarus in the depths of the broad path ground, and Eros, who is the most beautiful among the immortal gods, the limb melter, He overpowers the mind and the thoughtful counsel of all the gods and of all human beings in their breasts. So first there's chaos or chasm. Then there's Gaia. Then there's Tartarus. And then there's Eros. This is the basic beginnings. But it goes back to a moment before time, right? That first there's chaos. First there's basically no distinctions, there's no differentiation. Then there's Gaia, which is Mother Earth, okay, who sort of appears in the chasm. And beneath Gaia appears Tartarus. So Gaia kind of separates, Gaia in her appearance separates the chasm between an upper portion and a lower portion. And then, so the place of the dead shows up, Tartarus. Then the next entity to make its way in the world, to make its way into reality, is Eros. Love, desire, probably better to say desire. Desire. And then it becomes a very interesting, and then the whole story begins to get a little bit more interesting, because after Eros comes on the scene, suddenly Gaia gives birth to her own husband's son. Right? She suddenly births Uranus, however you want to say his name. Uranus. She suddenly births starry sky. She suddenly births the sky. And the sky immediately fills up over her. And it's a very sexualized cosmology. It's a very sexualized origin. She gives birth asexually to the sky, and then the sky, because of Eros, wants to get back to the earth and begins to do all of these different things that bring forth more life on a regular basis. Right? But there's a lot of issues going on inside of this mythopoeic, inside of this making a narrative about how the world came into be. Our word, our contemporary term for talking about such things is cosmology. And there's that logos again, study of the cosmos. The rationale of the cosmos. Okay? And this word cosmos is basically the word in Greek for order. So a cosmology is always an accounting of the order. All right? Accounting for the order. Our cosmology is called... Our contemporary scientific cosmology, which is based on contemporary physics, is called Big Bang Theory. Not to be confused with what happens at the beginning of Hesiod's. It's the Big Bang Theory, right? That everything just sort of whoosh. There's nothing, there's only this one singularity, and then there's an explosion, and then the universe happens, right? There's obviously a lot more scientificness going on inside of all that. But the point, of course, is that in some ways it's as a cosmology, it has its own mythopoeic character. It's a making of a narrative, right? It's narrating the beginning so that we can have something we can have something to kind of start from. But remember how we were talking about the last few classes? We were talking about Jasper's notions of ultimate conditions and Frere's notions of oppression and the need for justice, right? And one of the things that you see in these stories being put forward by Hesiod, in these stories that are being put forward by Homer, is the recognition that there's a lot of injustice going on. There's a lot of chicanery, right? How many people in here actually read close enough to answer this question? How did the first race of gods called the Titans? First there was Uranus and Gaia. And then she gave birth to Cronos, Rhea, and a whole host of gods called the Titans. But Uranus didn't like those kids. And he kept wanting to be with Gaia, but every time he was with Gaia, a new kid would come out of it. Like, because she's just fertility, right? So just a little bit of his reign gets on her, and boom, there's a new god. Right? This is basically it. It's stiff, but if you actually could read the sexuality of the Greek, it's stiff in a whole other way. It's a very sexual story, right? So Eros, desire, he gets his thing going, right? Limb melting desire. Uranus suddenly popped because Gaia. After desire shows up, Gaia becomes so excited that Uranus pops out of her. And then Uranus looks down and sees his mother wife. And it's like, I got to get that. And it's just going. And then every time he touches her, boom, a new god is born. So what does he do? He's like, I can't have that though. I'm not going to pay child support. And he grabbed the kid and he'd stuff it back up inside Gaia. So she began to moan and groan with the weight of the fact that she had all of these gods rumbling around inside of her that had been born from her, and they wanted to do what they do, right? Because they're all the elemental forces of the universe. So finally she gives birth to her last son, Cronos, who we sometimes refer to as Father Time. So his name is the basis of chronology, accounting for time, right? Chronic, you have it with you all the time. Not that chronic weed, because that runs out sometimes. But you know, chronic, that stuff that's like you get sick and it's with you forever. It's with you for all time. You have a chronic illness. Well, look. So guys like, look, Cronos, baby. Mama's so full of your brothers and sisters, and just, you know, I've just had it up to here with this crap. And the next time that man shows up, I want you to take this incredibly jagged sickle and I want you to castrate him, and let's stop this. Mama's had enough. I ain't got time for this. So then it's actually very well described in the story that basically what Cronos does is the next time that Uranus looks down at his mother and he's like, I gotta have that again, and he goes down to Gaia, Cronos reaches out with one hand and he grabs the unmentionables and he takes this really jagged stone sickle and what, pow, castrates his father. And then he throws the testicles over his shoulder and they go into Oceanus. And from Oceanus,
From the testicles hitting the water, Aphrodite, the goddess of desire, is born. Venus on the half shell, you've seen the painting. Right? And everywhere his blood drops on his mother, something pops up. Well, so we're back to oppression. We're back to, right? His mother is being oppressed. Her child reaches out in violence and stops the oppression. But then what does Cronos do? Every time, he takes over. And his sister wife, Rhea, who's another personification of the earth goddess, right? The goddess in terms of the pastures, the mountains. Cronos and Rhea start getting together and they start having kids. Hades, Poseidon, Demeter, Hera. These are names you're probably a little more familiar with. Zeus. Cronos, however, learned something. So instead of putting the children back where they came from, he takes them and he swallows them. So time swallows these natural forces. But Zeus, Mama Rhea, hides Zeus, and she gives Cronos, who's so busy doing other things, he's not paying attention to the child he's grabbing and eating. He grabs a big stone that's wrapped up like a baby, and he swallows it. These things don't have to be consistent because they're narratives, right? This is an important aspect to be thinking about, that in these stories, in these narratives, we're not looking for consistency and we're not even going to concern ourselves with contradictions. But we are looking for the fact that people from the source of our doubt and our uncertainty and our human condition are trying to figure out, trying to put forward a narrative about how the world is the way the world is. So Zeus is hidden aside, and Cronos doesn't get him, and his mother helps him one day, and they come, and he beats his father up, and all of the children that his father swallowed, they all begin vomiting back out of him. And Zeus then does something very important. And what we did here inside of this chapter is, because this is not something that Hesiod himself talks about, but Homer talks about it in the Iliad, right? And in the Iliad, Homer says, has Poseidon refer to the fact that at the beginning, when they had all been freed from the gut of time and they had all come into the world, rather than go to war, they did something still sexist because the women didn't get to participate. But yeah, it's a step forward. They did something almost democratic. They drew lots. Who gets to rule what part of the world? Okay? And they set up, and Zeus, therefore, wins the lot that gives him the rule of the sky with his great thunderbolt. And he, in a sense, instantiates justice, right? That things need to be ordered. Sky, waters, underworld. And to all of these, the world, the earth, the land itself belongs, right? So the sky overlooks the land. The water surrounds the land. And the underworld receives, upholds the land, and receives the dead of the land. But again, it's this question about where is justice? The Greek word dike. Where is justice? What is justice? How is justice? And we come to this realization that justice must be a proper order. So now the beginnings of philosophy. Here now the beginnings of philosophy. That we shall seek the skills and the cleverness and the knowledge that will allow us to contribute to and to order the world in a just way. Right? So philosophia, philos, endeared to Sophia. Sophia, your name, means wisdom, but it also, because I don't think you were here the first day, it means skill, cleverness, knowledge, and wisdom. We'll endear ourselves to wisdom which seeks justice, which seeks the right order. And this is what philosophy has been doing ever since. It's been trying to determine the order. But it starts with these things. It starts with these mythopoeic attempts to explain how there could be justice or how things came about. Okay. Nick, what is justice? Okay, paying somebody back for what they did wrong. Okay, you're Old Testament. All right, I like that. What's your name?
Haley.
Haley. What's justice?
I guess kind of like what you said, like
leveling out the playing field. Okay. Now, you said it's paying people back for when they do you wrong. You said it's leveling out the playing field. So you want to stick to the Old Testament eye for an eye thing, too. Oh, quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesses him that gives and him that takes. It is mightiest and the mightiest. Becomes the throned monarch as his crown. His scepter doth show the force of temporal power, the attributes of all majesty wherein doth set the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above the sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the heart of kings. And earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice none of us should see salvation. Daniel, what's justice?
I guess if I had to define justice, it would also be like, keeping out the law of order, but I guess that'd be,
Okay. Well, it's okay. I'm not dissing the Old Testament way of doing it, the eye for an eye. It's just, what other way of thinking about justice is there?
Other way of thinking about justice?
Yeah.
Other than eye for an eye, I guess.
So we got eye for an eye. Let me get this up here while you're thinking about how to say that. Eye for eye. And Haley was basically saying a kind of retribution that equalizes. Okay. All right, Daniel.
I guess it normally depends on the people that support it, right? Not what I was saying, the congregation, but like citizens itself, what the citizens want.
Okay.
It's for the people, even though it's not always considered right. If that makes sense.
All right.
Karma.
Order for the people. Somebody brought in a completely foreign word, karma. I'm the only one that's supposed to bring in a foreign word.
Who said karma?
What? Pierce, what? What's karma?
Like what goes around comes around.
Well, that's one view of karma. That's an Old Testament view of karma.
Okay. I
kind of beginning to wonder if y'all have not been very, very much influenced by the last 15 years of history.
I guess karma is more of a balance.
Now, that's an interesting thing, because in one sense, I've filled up this board, and there's nowhere else for me to write anything and make any sense. So, it's an interesting thing. What does Gandhi mean when he says, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind? Okay, Ian?
It's if we just go out of our way to, like, I just had it phrased perfectly. It's like we're constantly just paying each other back for wrongdoings and stuff.
Okay.
Like that. All it's going to do is just make everything worse.
All right. So what we get into with retributive justice, retribution, is that you actually can't get out of the cycle of retribution. And that's what's happening between Uranus and Kronos, and between Kronos and Zeus, but Zeus wants to stop that pattern. So he creates what my teacher, Barry Callicott, calls distributive justice. So, which is what you're kind of going towards, where everything is distributed, not equally, but with an equity. Y'all know the difference between equity and equality? What's your name?
Alex.
What's the difference between equity and equality, you think?
Equality may be
equal and equity. You have a buy-in. You have a part to play. So equity and equality. So the issue here would be that everybody in the United States of America, I said this the other day, and I think some people probably thought, you've got to be crazy. Everybody in the United States of America probably believes in equality, but they don't believe in equity. Right? Equity would be distributive justice. Equity would mean that there's enough power distributed out that nobody will be oppressed. Because you can have all kinds of views of equality, all kinds of metaphysical notions about how everybody's equal. And if you have absolutely no equity whatsoever, so that some people are kept out of the mixture, then really it's just so much, right? So distributive justice is this a very important point. Justice, then, has something to do with how power is used and how power is dispersed. Okay. And now, what? 6 classes into the semester, we have the real theme. Okay, we have the real theme. How do we find justice? And how do we instantiate a just society? How do we contribute to a just society, right? So you actually can also think in terms of justice is retributive. It's about paying back. Justice is distributive. It's about paying out, getting equity, getting investment. And justice is contributive. But now, what do we mean when we say justice is contributive? Do we mean that justice contributes?
No.
Why?
I guess for justice to be like right, I guess like it has, you have to have a group agree. Like if one person says like, oh, like I think that person deserves to die because he's a thief, and that's his justice, but like everybody else is like, no, like we just need to put him in prison, then that's contributive justice. It's not like...
It's on the way to contributive justice.
Yeah.
Yes. How can he continue to contribute, and how can we contribute to bettering that person? Assuming that, we don't create a prison system that itself is just living retribution. Mm-hmm. Right? Good. That's good. Because this then connects that notion of contributive justice, of our being together and contributing to a just situation, right, is very much connected to how I was talking about freedom, meaning what? The duty to be friends. But this requires us in a kind of Frerian moment, in a kind of Jaspersian moment, it requires us to pay attention to our ultimate situations, to pay attention to our human conditions, to pay attention to the places where oppression happens, and we contribute to oppression, not to justice. Right? Okay. I'm going to take